Ladies and gentlemen, we had a brief moment of crisis here, but thanks to the intelligence of our distinguished guest, the crisis has been solved and we can proceed. I have great privilege of introducing our Radner lecturer, who is Mr. Bayard Rustin. Mr. Rustin is 63 years old. He is executive director of the A. Philip Randolph Institute. His career in civil rights spans more than 30 years, during which he has taken part in the leading events of the struggle of our time. He has been arrested 24 times, and he once worked on a chain gang. I understand that that was in North Carolina, and as a consequence of his service, chain gangs were then abolished in that state. During the 1940s, he was Race Relations Secretary of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and in 1941, he was a youth organizer for A. Philip Randolph's March on Washington. 1941. The same year, he became the first field secretary of the newly formed Congress of Racial Equality. In subsequent years, he worked closely with Martin Luther King, helping to organize the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott, and drawing up plans in 1956 for the founding of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Mr. Rustin coordinated the 1957 prayer pilgrimage that brought 35,000 persons to Washington, D.C. He was deputy director of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, in which 250,000 persons participated and which paved the way for passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The A. Philip Randolph Institute, of which he is executive director, was named for the leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and Mr. Rustin's longtime associate. The institute was established in 1964 to promote voter registration, economic equality, and better relations between blacks, liberals, and unions. Mr. Rustin has been the institute's director since 1966. He writes a biweekly column on civil rights, and in 1977, he published Down the Line, a collection of his essays, newspaper reports, and columns. Mr. Rustin is the seventh William Radner lecturer, a very distinguished series. The lectureship was established by the Radner family in 1956. If you look inside your program, you will see the six predecessors, beginning with Harry S. Truman and ending with Robert Wood. With these few words, it will now be my privilege to introduce Mr. Rustin's series of lectures, From Freedom Ride to Ballot Box, the changing strategies of black struggle. Tonight's lecture, The Early Years, Building a Consensus for Freedom. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my privilege to introduce Mr. Bayard Rustin.
Thank you. Thank you. It's quite obvious that a number of people who work for me are here tonight. I see a lot of old friends, and to them I apologize, because I think it's the first time in my life I've ever been compelled to read a speech. They will wonder what have happened to my arms, which usually flay, but we shall see. Negro history during the 20th century has been marked by a remarkable and unprecedented social reformation. For centuries, black have been seen by the American society as subhuman, invisible men. Brought here in bondage and abandoned with the end of Reconstruction, the Negro remained at the bottom of the brutal caste system, and now, as then, discrimination and segregation was rampant in the New South, where blacks were excluded from the coming wealth of the industrial society. And yet, without a doubt, even though some blacks do not choose to admit it, we have risen from oppression and from discrimination to create the most dynamic social movement of our time in the United States, and certainly the most creative evolution for any minority anywhere in the world. Once considered political non-entities, blacks have become unique as a political force in the United States, which no politician dare disregard. This became quite clear to me on the day that Mr. Kennedy called Mrs. King when Martin was in jail. I instinctively and automatically knew at that moment that he was not calling out of affection, but out of the fact that blacks now had arrived politically. And from an economic underclass, landless, poverty-stricken, consigned to menial dead-end constructions and occupations, blacks have become participants in the mainstream of the technological society, far more than we are permitted to admit. The movement which enabled blacks to surmount the twin handicaps of racial and class discrimination have been rooted in three basic principles. When these principles have been active, racial progress has been made. At any point that these principles were violated by so-called leaders, then we were in trouble. What were these principles? They were integration, nonviolence, and constitutional means, and coalition politics. That is to say, a belief that racial progress could only be achieved in an integrated framework, a commitment to the tactics of nonviolence, including constitutional means and the intelligent use of courts, and finally, the realization that broad permanent change cannot be achieved by a minority unless it is in coalition with other minorities, liberals, the trade union movement, etc. Now, that is not to say that there have not been times when proponents of various brands of frustration politics, like Carmichael and Rap Brown, there have been times when they have rejected these principles. And for a short time, they achieved untold attention and notoriety. But the very fact that they did not accept those three principles meant that they were in a dead end politically, and that soon they would pass, as they now have, with a dozen others like them, into total political oblivion. Now, these three principles have a common theme, and that theme is hopefulness. This is the most important quality for change. Men do not achieve any revolutionary act because they are desperate. They achieve a revolutionary thrust as they begin to move upwardly. Revolution is the result of hopefulness. And if one looks at integration, it is based on hopefulness, nonviolent means, a hopeful concept of the nature of man. Coalition politics, a belief that even though you are not with me today, there is a common ground on which we can struggle politically tomorrow. For only when blacks have adhered to integration, nonviolence, and coalition politics have they succeeded in moving the man-made mountains of Jim Crow. At such times, they have removed racial barriers that have been carefully erected over a span of centuries. They have won decisions in the courts. They have passed laws in the Congress, they have had the support of presidents, and they have encouraged the majority of the American people to join them. The notion, my friends, that anything creative came out of the rioting is simply untrue. In Watts today, there are less hospital beds, more unemployment, less of a transportation system, and more people. And the argument that somehow or other rioting really did something is quite contrary to all that the facts will show. It is true, of course, that integration has not always been the dominant philosophy of the Negro movement. At times, long simmering anger have boiled over into expressions of violence. At other times, nationalism has had its day. Doctrines bred of frustration and hopelessness have marked the history of all social movements, particularly those confined with seemingly insurmountable odds like the blacks have had to face. The point is that those periods which saw the rise of ideologies of hopelessness were precisely the period when past achievements were blunted, when hard-won consensus of support was diminished, when confusion, aimlessness, and disarray replaced unity and purposefulness. Now, if one wants really to understand what happened from 1909 until 1954, one has two things one must do. One is to explore the NAACP and its history, which I shall not go into at great length since it is so well known. There are two personalities that one simply must understand if one is to understand what was happening to black people in that period. One of these men was Marcus Garvey, and the other one was Philip Randolph. And we must see them to understand what really was happening. One cannot and one need not argue with the proposition that Garvey made some contributions and was an intellectual figure. The fact is, the mass movement he commanded for a few stormy years numbered in the hundreds of thousands. The more ardent of his followers embraced Garvey's doctrine of pan-Africanism as a legitimate alternative to integration. Others, and most, caring little about the philosophical subtleties that Garvey propounded, and noting that he was far removed from most other black intellectuals, nevertheless entrusted Garvey with their meager savings and then eagerly awaited the coming of the black capitalism bonanza, which he had promised. But of course it never came. And it is shocking that people could ever have thought black capitalism, then or now, could have any appreciable effect. If it is true that white capitalists manipulating trillions of dollars permit poverty to exist in Appalachia and amongst poor whites in every city, who thinks that black capitalists manipulating a few million dollars can do anything about lifting the lumpen proletariat into the working classes or to get the working classes into the middle classes? So the Garvey was in many respects a profound and magnificent hoax. And yet, despite this his widespread popularity, Garvey left very little of either relevance or permanence to the racial struggle today. His career draws the notice of historians, to be sure. But his ideas mean little to the current situation of the black masses. And it is interesting that every public opinion poll in the last 10 years has shown that far over 60, 70, 80% of all blacks are interested in integration as a means of solving their problem. And as each passing year brings more progress for blacks within the context of the American society, Garvey's nationalist ideas become less and less relevant. Now, there are those who would explain Garvey's ellipse as a result of his financial bungling or the fact that the government was out to get him. They say Garvey the man failed, but his philosophy he espoused contains merit. Such an explanation is insufficient. Ultimately, Garvey failed because the black working classes turned their back on him. And the emergence of the CIO, which put blacks back to work, diminished even those few. And the reason it diminished them was that the formation of bringing blacks into the trade union movement reestablished hopefulness in the society. Now, moreover, these blacks who were acquiring a sense of the shape of the coming struggle recognized that Gandhi was not a revolutionary as he claimed to be, but was in fact a counter-revolutionary, an economic reactionary cavorting with the Ku Klux Klan. He was a thoroughgoing capitalist and, in a sense, an accommodationist. Like Washington before him, Garvey rose to prominence at a time when it was becoming increasingly obvious that the rising expectation of Negroes were soon to be shattered. For Washington, the time was the acknowledged end of the Reconstruction, a time when freedmen were disenfranchised, deprived of their social and economic rights, stripped of what was thought to be their legitimate legacy of the emancipation. For Garvey, it was a time of trial immediately after World War I, when hopelessness again appeared, when returning troops discovered that making the world safe for democracy did not signal the spread of democracy at home. Garvey rose to power on the hopelessness of the 20s, when more blacks were being lynched than ever before, when there was more black unemployment than ever before, when the blacks were being driven off the land in the South, and when brutality reigned. Now, in other words, Garvey taught, again what Washington taught, in that blacks should now, and I quote, cast down your buckets where you are, unquote. That is not the statement of a revolutionary or a man who can have anything fundamental to do with the black struggle. That is the, in other words, to engage, that is not to engage in real struggle. To let down your buckets where you are is accommodationist. It is the absence of struggle. Now then, Marcus Garvey's words to the Negro worker are interesting. I quote, "Always keep your scale of wages a little lower than the white until you are able to become, through proper leadership," by which he meant Garvey, "your own employer." This is perhaps the most irrational proposal that was ever suggested to black people. Now, on the other hand, it is ironic that it was A. Philip Randolph who, perceiving in Garvey the makings of some incipient radical, should have provided Garvey with his first soapbox speaking opportunity in Harlem. For these two men were soon to become bitter antagonists, as Randolph's life was to be sharply different from Garvey's. Because Randolph believed, and still believes, that progress for blacks lay almost exclusively in a single American institution so far as economics are concerned, and that is in a strong interracial unions. What Randolph did not move with the swiftness with which Marcus Garvey rose and fell, but his contributions were far more reaching and lasting. Where Garvey's social vision was narrow, Randolph's was total. He was always aware, Randolph, as Garvey was in his own way, of the economic dimensions of discrimination. His various campaigns were directed at both class and racial bias. Randolph understood that for Negroes, the arena of struggle was right here in the United States, and that the particulars of the struggle must be aimed at massive reconstruction of the nation's basic institution. And Randolph was the first and the only black leader in this country who has ever called for a profound and deep redistribution of wealth. And he has consistently held to that view throughout his career. In this respect, therefore, Randolph was unique amongst black leaders. That is to say, Randolph was the first and only in this period. It will be interesting to note when I get to my third period that Martin Luther King was very much concerned to understand that a redistribution of wealth was essential not only to black progress, but if blacks were to continue the hopefulness which would make the continuation of the struggle in nonviolence possible. Randolph also possessed a keen sense of strategy and tactics. It was this sense which set him apart from black leadership in those painful years when the nation began to hear the first decisive murmurings of the civil rights movement. The nation heard those murmurings in 1909 when the Niagara Movement was founded, and again a year later and a little louder in 1910 when the NAACP was established. The establishment of the NAACP, my friends, if you will go back to 1909 and just look at the headlines of the New York Times, was one of the most glorious and daring experiments, and it was great in that it was founded on the three principles. And some of the finest people who established it were Jews, were Catholics, white Protestants, militant blacks, all working together. Now let's look at what the NAACP asked for, because it's a great lesson here. What the NAACP asked for in 1920 was the right to vote, access to education on the same basis as everybody else, a fair trial and decent judges, an end to lynching and burning at the hands of mobs, equal and integrated public accommodations. Now I point out to you that this program addressed itself to the basic principles of human dignity and constitutional rights, but there is not in the founding of the NAACP statement a single word encompassing economic rights. Now, this dimension was added later by Randall. Nor did the NAACP 1919 document deal with the strategic means for resolving discrimination. How could it? However, this lapse is in no sense a reflection on the NAACP. During those difficult years, not a single person nor a single organization knew nor could have known what a strategy for social change was, because there was no political base amongst blacks on which you could place a strategy. You cannot have a strategy without a political base. Now, Du Bois and Garvey thought they knew, but the course of history has demonstrated that neither of them knew, and that the philosophies they projected, which A. Philip Randolph was to fight, were erroneous and were not going to get us where we wanted to go. The fact is that the racial caste system had so pervaded American society in the early 1900s that it had totally destroyed the potential for creative mass action. And this condition had demoralized black leaders, forcing them into activities not derived nor related to any power base. Now, what makes Randolph unique is that he began to feel for where now can we have a power base on which a political strategy can be faced. Now, I take nothing from the NAACP, which was doing its job in another important way, but I must give Randolph credit for having perceived that this political fact was there and needed to be addressed to. Now, the American political process, which has provided some measure of hope for the immigrants who came from Europe, was foreclosed to black participation. And when people talk about why don't blacks rise in the way that others who came from Europe did, the answer is profoundly simple. It was not that they were bright. It was not that they had money. It was not that they had skills. It was that they were permitted to vote and had a political base from which they could then operate. Now, Woodrow Wilson looked upon Negroes with aristocratic disdain. Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover were neither suited by temperament nor philosophy to lend moral or political support to the oppressed. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt is undoubtedly the most overrated of any of them. Even though Roosevelt from 1936 on received the overwhelming majority of the black vote, he declined over and over again ever to put his prestige as president on the line, even for the anti-lynching bill, when it was clear that 75% of the American people were against lynching. Now, nor could blacks appeal to the Supreme Court for redress. Republican appointees to that body gave it a visibly conservative tone. Not until midway through the 40s did the influence of Roosevelt's appointees begin to be felt in sufficient respect about the liberalization of the court's outlook. Now here we are, shunned by political parties, rejected in the court, and possessing near zero political power. It is a miracle that blacks had to look outside the normal channels of democracy to press their cause. But even here, conditions in American society seriously limited their options. Now, a protest moving the scale mounted by Martin Luther King would have been unthinkable at that time. Most Negroes lived in the rural South, where simply putting a sheet over your head could terrify them, where an effort to integrate public transportation had failed, or a sit-in at the lunch counter would have elicited swift and violent reprisal. There were some 277 lynchings between 1922 and 34. In the South, membership in the Ku Klux Klan reached a high peak in the 20s. And there were also now proto-fascist groups organizing in the North, not only to brutalize blacks, but to brutalize Jews and Catholics. That was a very difficult atmosphere. The concerted effort to destroy the nascent radical movement in the United States climaxed the Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer's Red Scare in 19. And while it did not directly affect blacks, it had a profound effect upon our ability to struggle. Because the Palmer raids seriously disorganized and disoriented all the white allies who, under a different set of circumstances, could have been valuable in the struggle for freedom. Now let's look at the radical parties of the period. The radical parties displayed little understanding of the spatial problems confronting Americans. The Socialist Party, for instance, was strongly committed to the ideal of racial equality, but failed to offer a platform directed at racial injustice. It did, however, have a program which, had it been implemented, would have been helpful to black masses, and that program, of course, would have been socialism. The overthrow of the capitalist system by democratic means, the institution of democratic control of the means of production and the allocation of goods and resources. But the socialists had no radical program for blacks. As its esteemed leader, Eugene Debs, said, "We have nothing special to offer the Negro, and we cannot make special appeals to all the races." Now, as a longtime socialist and as national chairman of the Social Democrats USA, the party of Debs and Thomas, I look upon this failure of the socialists to make that special appeal as a tragic error for socialism and for blacks. Because of the Socialist Party's lack of foresight in this respect, a generation of blacks came and went, untouched by the doctrines of socialism and unacquainted with the brilliance of their visionary leaders. The fact of the matter is, if today young blacks are going to be able to make contributions in the future, they are going to have to join youthful, left-wing, democratic political groups, because that is where the training for the nature of the job in the future must come from. Now, the two exceptions to this were Randolph and Chandler, editors of the socialist-oriented magazine, The Messenger. As a democratic organization generally moved by human suffering, the socialists might have contributed much to help if they had not been so narrow. Now, let us look at the other radical organization, the Communist Party, which went out of its way to enlist blacks, particularly black activists and intellectuals. But while the Communists had a larger black membership during the period than other left-wing groups, they too ultimately failed to effectively appeal to the black masses. For one thing, the Communists were always viewed with suspicion as a potentially subversive group. Their leaders never had the respect that Thomas and Debs had. And as a people already stigmatized by color of their skin, Negroes were not eager to enter a political party with its notoriety and double jeopardy, and therefore they stayed away. Furthermore, the Communist position on the racial questions, that is, they favored the creation of a black state a la Mohammed today, was ridiculously utopian to most blacks and highly relevant to the Negro's struggle for survival. Finally, the Communist Party failed to attract broad support in the black community for the same reason it failed to get broad support in the labor movement, in the academic world, in politics, or in any other institutions they attempted to dominate. Simply put, the Communist primary concern was not with black masses or with the working people, but with the global objectives of the Soviet Union. Sooner or later, these objectives were bound to surface. Now, I learned about this firsthand. Having been for several years an active member of the Young Communist League, I was drawn to the Communists because they appeared to be the only organization expressing concrete concern about black people. I first encountered the Communists at the Philadelphia meeting on the Scottsboro case, where a guy came over and wanted to know, you want to hand out some leaflets. I took his leaflets, and 6 months later, I was a member of the Young Communist League. At this point, the Young Communists were told by the high command of the Communist Party that I was to be assigned to CCNY, where instead of attending classes, I was simply to matriculate and take examinations and organize for the Young Communist League. Eventually, I was placed in charge of a campaign to combat discrimination in the armed forces. This was, of course, during the period of the Hitler-Stalin Pact, when World War II was referred to as Roosevelt's War of Imperialism. The invasion of Russia by Nazi Germany in June 1941 changed all that. Now the war was no longer an imperious venture, but a struggle for the freedom and democracy. Everything we were told must be sacrificed for the war effort. All energy, the party said, must go now into opening a second front. This meant, of course, that I was called in and told that my project to desegregate the army was off, and that all those black leaders like Randolph who continued throughout the war to struggle for better racial conditions were to become, as I was to become, subject to a drum fire of communist criticism. I resigned immediately from the party and did not do so simply because my project was dropped, but because the communists now demonstrated to me, as they had to most black intellectuals and trade unionists, that they were not in the least concerned about what was happening in the United States. They cared only about what, in their view, was best for the Soviet Union. They were prepared to sacrifice everything, including the urgent needs of black people, for the Soviet Union. And the integrated army now would have to wait. Now, the CP began to develop its image as a supporter of the Negro rights during the late 20s racial riots, in which blacks suffered tremendously. These riots had often been triggered by the efforts of Negroes to assert their economic and social rights. In fact, my friends, in one summer, 40 blacks in 1917 were killed in East St. Louis in that riot. And this cast a terrible spell over black people. Now, the totality of repression, terrorism, and political indifference was to render efforts at collective action impossible for a number of years yet. The only alternatives were utopian fantasies like Garvey's, or some form of personal, artistic, and spiritual outlet, as in image. The prevailing sense of hopelessness for any meaningful political strategy contributed to the cultural phenomenon known as the Harlem Renaissance. The Harlem Renaissance substituted black image and black art for what might well have been political action or mass action if the objective situation had been different. And this we had out of this Renaissance, militant poem by Claude McKay. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their 1,000 blows deal 1 death blow. Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. That might have well been political action in another situation where political action was possible. Now, if the 20s were to be the blacks' probably darkest decade, the 30s brought a new sense of hope. The Depression visited itself more harshly on blacks than anyone else. But blacks saw in the Depression at least that everybody was pressed to the wall. The Depression touched all colors and classes. And while this may seem a very minor thing, in social change, the fact that other people are also in trouble is the basis for a creative impulse which can move in the political direction. Now, these strategies of despair symbolized by the Garvey movement now give way to high expectation, which accompanied the formation of the New Deal and the CIO. These expectations shared by black and white alike proved well-founded. The unions, which formed the nucleus of CIO strength, the automobile workers, the mine workers, and other organized mass production industries, where blacks made up an increasing large number in the force. Along with the radically progressive AFL unions like the ILGWU, these unions added an important dimension to the American context, and let's see what that was. The unions were the driving force in the fight to win substantial improvements in the material conditions of black industrial workers. Most of these unions were led by men who, for both practical and principled reasons, believed that black and white should be organized together. The unions hastened the end of the manipulation of black workers by employers who saw the Negro a force of cheap labor, a potential strike breaker, a black mass which could be profitably used to depress wages. Now, this is interesting, and I recommend academic people to pay attention to this sentence, since so many of them are anti-union. In the 30s, the unions became the first mass interracial institution in the nation where segregation had been the rule to begin desegregating. Pity is that the churches, the universities, and the corporations were not to move for another 30 years. They did not get on fire until the 60s. And these unions presented Negroes with organizing skills, a sense of participation in the important social struggle. It trained them as to how to struggle. This was to have incalculable effect on the later civil rights movement. Now let me point out what I mean by that. It is interesting, when Mrs. Rosa Parks sat down, it was not Martin Luther King who started to organize the boycott. It was a man whose name was E.D. Nixon. And it is significant that he came out of the Pullman porters and was Randolph's representative in the South. It is interesting that when we wanted to set up CORE, the adult we had to go to get help was Randolph. It is interesting to note that when Martin Luther King's back is to the wall in Birmingham and they're taking his cars away, he did the logical thing. He went to Birmingham. Why? Because there blacks were organized in the steel and other unions. They were making money, they had cars, and he could respond to them. Like the unions, the New Deal, although it did not address the unique problems created by racial discrimination, did provide encouragement to the civil rights movement. For the coming of the CCC, the WPA, the Wagner Act, and programs inaugurated under FDR's administration, brought an end to the laissez-faire tradition which government had had since the birth of the nation. Blacks reasoned, if Roosevelt can do something to help the poor, if he can do something like the Wagner Act to help the laborers, if he can help youth, it's about time we got off our behinds and see to it that he does something to help blacks. Now, the Wagner Act had a more immediate effect even than that, because the moment the Wagner Act said that unions had to work the right to organize and bargain collectively, almost overnight, the 12-year struggle that Randolph had put up to get the Pullman porters recognized was indeed there. The victory made Randolph the most aggressive and best-known Negro in the United States, and also paved the way for the emergence of the most important strategy in the annals of American social struggle. Now, what was that strategy? It was a two-pronged approach where the NAACP went into the courts, and Randolph was now to lead the five or six most important street demonstrations which were to lead to Martin Luther King. The strategy was be in the courts and be in the streets. Make what is happening in the streets reflect in the courts, in the Congress where you have no political power, and get Congress with its accommodation to the streets to have a greater effect in opening up the streets. The coming of the 1940s brought a heretofore unknown coherent strategy to the civil rights movement. This did not come from Garvey. It did not come from Du Bois. It came from, on the one hand, Randolph and the NAACP on the other. Now, as America busied herself with war primetime preparations, the civil rights forces launched their assault in these directions. A. Philip Randolph and his followers were organizing nonviolent direct action projects, and the NAACP, in a relentless and brilliant campaign, was piling case upon case upon case for 40 years. To understand Randolph's unique ability as a civil rights leader, one must recognize that he was both the product of the Negro experience and the product of a radical political tradition. And I point out that any blacks who are going to make a future contribution have got to have had a radical political experience just as much as the experience as blacks, or they cannot provide a leadership. As a Negro, Randolph understood the depths of discrimination as few white men could. He learned to persevere in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds. He valued racial pride and what it meant to the black worker. From socialism, he gained the ability to order his mind, to attend to his disciplined thinking, to gain a sense of strategy and tactics, and most important, he gained an understanding of the economic underpinnings of discrimination. It was this combination of these traditions that gave depth to Randolph's vision. Now, I come to a very important part of this. Randolph examined and rejected the dominant thinking of black leaders of his time. He rejected Booker Washington's gradualism. He fought Garvey's nationalism. He fought W.E.B. Du Bois' concept of the talented tenth. And Randolph proved to be right, and they proved to be wrong. Randolph rejected these trends and insisted that any movement had to be based in max action and had to name now specific goals. This campaign in 1941, the March on Washington, was symbolic inauguration of this new dual thrust in the civil rights movement. The march was the first mass nonviolence ever tried or threatened by Negro Americans, who until then almost exclusively had fought discrimination through court actions that were, of course, becoming increasingly successful, or through individual acts of protest, or through cultural rebellion, or through internalization of despair in some form of frustration politics. There had never before been an attempt at such a large-scale collective mass direct action as Randolph was then proposing. Randolph's campaign was the first instance of organized protest against economic oppression. Early expressions of protest had been directed at terrorism in the South, the poll tax, the grandfather's clause, etc. The organizers of the march, however, had one overriding objective, and that was to get jobs in government for blacks. Now, it was the new immigrants to the North who made the march possible. They became the ultimate beneficiaries of the march's demands because they themselves had, by the mere fact of having come into Chicago and New York, into these ghettos, their act of migration had made the march feasible in Randolph's mind. He could not have had people march from Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama from the sharecroppers. He had to have an urban base. For until the mid-30s and 40s, there was no black working class large enough or concentrated enough to support a national movement of any scope envisioned by Randolph. The terms of its strategy, the major march of success, was enforcing the federal government the first time in history to deal with Negroes as equals. Now, I am now going to leave out this section in which I describe how Randolph got the executive order, I will simply tell you that he got it by threatening to march, and that this was an important movement. Whatever the inner sentiments of FDR was, his impulse was to ignore all complaints on the part of blacks and listen to what he himself had to say. For fear that any positive action would divide the Democratic Party, whose unity he saw as a basis for his own power, and he did not want to lose getting his domestic program through. Randolph. Concentrated and in the organized black community. By Randolph. The terms of its strategy, the major march of success, was enforcing the federal government the first Randolph, who had made some strategic mistakes himself in winning the struggle with the Pullman Company, well understood that Negroes were in no position to issue ultimatum if they were weak, fearful, and unorganized. Thus, when he announced the march, this is what he said. Power and pressure do not reside in the few, a small group of intellectuals. They lie and flow from the masses. Power does not even rest with the masses as such. Power is the active principle of only the organized masses. And I repeat that everything that Martin Luther King did in the second period, which I shall be discussing tomorrow night, logically proceeded from the groundwork which Randolph had set up. Now, Executive Order 8802 was issued on June 25, 1941. It banned discrimination in defense industries and government establishments, and a Fair Employment Practice Commission was set up with some teeth in it for the first time since Reconstruction. The march also set crucial strategic precedents for the civil rights movement, where there had been a vacuum. For now, there was a mass base of potential strength concentrated and in the organized black community. Now, the Negro masses' tactical vision began to expand, and Randolph had, after all, acted within the constitutional framework and had held to these principles which we have been discussing. Nor was this executive decree the only source of hope. For now, midway through the 40s, three decades-long campaign of the NAACP in the courts was beginning to be more and more effective. Persuaded by skillful arguments of such attorneys as Thurgood Marshall and William Hastie, the Supreme Court now began to move. The next important decision was the Irene Morgan decision. That was a ruling which said in interstate travel, blacks have the right to sit in any part of the bus they want. Now, this combination of direct action and legal action was causing the nation to confront the call for racial equality. Both the federal government and the courts had, with much prodding, begun to admit the existence of discrimination and that something should be done about it. Thus, it was only natural that an organization committed to spread the techniques of nonviolence should now emerge, and that organization was the Congress of Racial Equality. The hard interracial group which set up the core in 1942 bears absolutely no resemblance to that core as it exists today. The early core was established by individuals who passionately dedicated to the principle of integration. Today's core is run by black segregationists. Roy Innes, its central national director, preaches a crude brand of separatism. He has advocated Senate confirmation of Carswell on the ground that Carswell's ardent hostility to integration would help balance the court's integrationist majority. Even more celebrated is Innes's conference with Lester Maddox and other Dixocrats in an effort to devise a formula to reinstitute dual school system. But perhaps the most disgusting thing CORE has done is Mr. Innes going to Africa to sit down with General Amin of Uganda to congratulate him for having sent the people who were of Indian descent out of the country, having taken their money and valuables. And to describe Mr. Amin under these circumstances as the most noble black man of the 20th century. The Foxian framework which guided CORE in its early days was rooted in a far different tradition. And here again, in the second period, Martin Luther King was to benefit from CORE, as we all have benefited from Martin Luther King. It was founded by pacifists, mostly members of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Democracy, integration, and nonviolence were its hallmark. Its officers were democratically elected, and up until 1966, all of CORE's campaign were models of biracial cooperation, integration, and without violence. Next to A. Philip Randolph, Gandhi had more direct influence on the development of the civil rights strategies of the 40s than any other individual. And here again, it is important to understand what it was that CORE had to say. It had to say what Gandhi had to say and what Martin Luther King later had to say. That a movement must be prepared to accept suffering. That a movement must be prepared to forgive. That a movement must have a direct and concrete strategy. That strategy must be related to schools, if you're talking about schools, and not go on bridges in order to get into and close them down in order to get integrated schools. The strategy must fit. And that more important than anything else, one must be prepared to pay the price of freedom. He taught that no movement can survive simply by having a correct program or by following intelligent tactics. A movement must also possess a relationship to and have an understanding of the roots of the social struggle in which it is engaged. Without such an understanding, Gandhi felt a social movement will ultimately collapse from lack of discipline. Now, why then in the mid-60s did factions in the black community turn their backs on Gandhi and adopt the rhetoric of violence and revolution when in fact armed struggle was both implausible and irrelevant? Why did the new left embrace violence, knowing full well the interracial violence was historically visited, that violence was historically visited most terribly on those who are at the bottom of the ladder? Part of the answer, I think, is that the advocates of black power failed to do what they accused others of doing. And that is that to the degree that I find militant blacks today, to that degree do I find blacks who know absolutely nothing about the history of black people. That is the tragedy. And all of the unsound notions are the result of not having read history. And to compare, for most blacks, a sense of their heritage arises naturally out of their personal experience. Even my own early background was, in a sense, important to everything I've done since. I was born in Westchester, Pennsylvania, a town rich in history and culture. There was a great Quaker tradition, and there, when I was a child, I was taken to some of the big homes to see where the slaves were held and went through many of the passages which went from house to house as they were hiding the slaves. The anti-slavery movement had lived there, and you could see it in the town's architecture. There, a few miles away, was Christiana, where the great Christiana riot took place when they tried to take runaway slaves back to Maryland. My grandmother took me there on several occasions to see where these black men had stood. There was a sense in which, in my home, Dean Pickens visited, W.E.B. Du Bois came to the high school to speak, and my mother took me there. My grandmother was one of the founders of the day nursery, the garden club, the community center, the kindergarten, and the summer Bible school. It is not that all blacks are reared in the new mold, which the books and the newspapers love to print. That is, my mother was a whore, my father ran numbers, etc., etc. There were, in my town, great people. Roland Hayes came to sing. Madame Ivante came to Cheney State Teachers College down the road, and I was taken to hear her. Arthur Huff Fawcett and his sister Jessie came to town to give lectures. And out of this came an understanding of the nature for struggle, because I had seen men who struggle. Now, the violence of World War II, the brutality to the Jews under Hitler, and the potential destructive use of atomic power brought an added element to the domestic situation in the United States, which encouraged Kaur to test out Gandhi's tactics. It is an amazing thing how at the end of the war, almost automatically, people began to feel that they did not want more violence now. What had happened to the Jews? The violence of war, the bomb. And this gave Kaur a great time to go out now and to begin to organize. National sentiment was profoundly changing. And so in light of these developments, Kaur was stimulated to take a protest campaign that would provide a direct challenge to Jim Crow. Our campaign was called the Journey of Reconciliation. And it consisted of interracial groups, 8 white and 8 black, riding buses and trains all over the Upper South, with whites sitting in the back and blacks sitting in the front. To make a long story short, many of us went to the chain gang, but we came out of that experience with a pattern. And that pattern was turned over by the NAACP to black veterans all over the South, and hundreds of men from 1947 on were arrested in those buses, remained nonviolent in those buses, and went to jail on the basis of the pattern which Kaur had established. Now, some blacks regarded participation in the Journey of Reconciliation with scarcely muted hostility. But the Journey of Reconciliation proved important, and again was to do something that was to give King and Rosa Parks courage. It proved that, in fact, you could sit down, and even if you ended up on the chain gang, you could write an essay when you came off the chain gang and destroy the chain gang in North Carolina, and that you could go back home having done this and be a hero. That is to say that by 1950, the greatest transition that had taken place amongst black people was that they had begun to lose their fear of white people. And this came because they had been engaged in struggle in the street. Now, A. Philip Randolph was to come back on the scene again shortly. The renewed activities of Randolph were also drawing attention to mass action again. And this project was launched in 1947, was directed at segregation in the armed forces. Randolph demanded that an executive order be issued by Truman to eliminate discrimination in the armed forces. I will never forget the day Randolph read his statement in the Senate, and Senator Morse turned to him and said, "Mr. Randolph, what you are proposing in the midst of war is treason." You will remember we were still in the Korean War at that time. And Randolph said, "If it is treason, then I expect to go to jail. But I will call upon blacks to refuse to serve in the armed forces." Again, I shall cut it short by merely saying that when 18 young blacks in 2 weeks piled into the jails and were prepared to stay for the duration, Truman called Randolph on the phone and asked him if he would come to debate it. Not a single act of violence or ugliness occurred on the part of those 18 men. Not a single one of them asked to be excused. Not a single lawyer stood with one of them. They all looked the judge in the face, unlike some of the so-called civil disobedience during the last conflict, said to the judge, "I have come, I have brought my bag, I am prepared to go to jail, because until we get enough in jail, we will never get movement." Thank God we do not have now merely to depend on that kind of sacrifice, because the political strength which we are developing makes a totally different kind of movement possible. And while there were those among the established leadership who expressed reservation about the civil disobedience campaign against the draft, these young men did go in, and then Truman on July the 26, 1948, decreed precisely what Randolph wanted, that discrimination in the armed forces was over. And I am saddened to report to people of Columbia that that ill-informed General Eisenhower twice flew in from Europe to tell Senate committees that any effort to discriminate, to desegregate the armed forces was going to have a deleterious effect upon the army and literally make an army impossible. In open rebuff to the Dixocrats, the party's liberal wing in 1948, led by Humphrey, put forth a democratic platform that addressed itself to specific economic and social injustice suffered by racial minorities. It called for an anti-lynch bill, a voting rights measure, the establishment of an FEPC, integration in interstate travel, home rule for Washington, D.C., and the creation of a civil rights commission. And here again, Mr. Randolph played a vital role. I shall never forget, we are outside the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, Mr. Randolph and about 400 or 500 people. We'd been there for 2 days. And a young man came out and said, "Mr. Randolph, I'm Hubert Humphrey, and I want to tell you I'm with you people." And Mr. Randolph said, "Young senator, don't tell me. Go inside and tell them." And the fact is, Humphrey did go inside. He did tell them. Now, it was not because Randolph merely mentioned this to Humphrey that I presume Humphrey did it. It was that there was movement for the first time in 1948, or people marching in front of a major convention, and it is not a happenstance that that was the first convention which had anything of importance to say about what was happening to black people. My friends, After this, the NAACP, undergirded by direct action, had moved black people to a readiness for open, nonviolent mass conflict. The fear was now gone. Social dislocation was soon to be used to make clear that black people would not abandon the long struggle for justice, that they would be bombed, they would be murdered, that they would march in the streets. But before this justice could come a few steps closer, hundreds of thousands would indeed have to take to the streets. Some would be shot, and some would be killed in the streets. And there was to come a man who was to be a leader like unto none black people had ever known. It is about him and the protest movement that I will discuss tomorrow night. Thank you.